We're gonna go. As we get ready to get started this morning, let's have a word of prayer to set our mind. Our dear Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for the day that You've given us. We thank You for this time that we come together each first day, with our purpose being to honor, to set our minds on You, honor Christ for what He did for us, and to learn from Your Word so that we can better emulate Him and be lights in the world that in which we live. Be with us as we focus our mind in on mainly Samson today and the lessons that we can learn from there. Again, to one, appreciate You, and two, to live as lights in the world around us. We ask these things in Christ's name. Amen. All right. Brent had a comment he wanted to make. So as a summary of the last class, so I'll let him make that, and then we'll get started. Brent? Yes. And let me actually summarize what he said in a comment that Freddie said as we started, as I was walking up today, to summarize that study as a whole. And it's absolutely true. I don't think we question, and I think my last slide was, let's not overlook the faith of Jephthah, which is what is pointed out in Hebrews chapter 11, as well as let's not overlook the faith of Jephthah's daughter, who, you know, he was going to carry the vow out regardless, but she didn't go along kicking and screaming. She also said, whatever you promised to the Lord to do, do it, right? So there's faith on both of their parts. The only thing I think that's ever really questioned is what the vow was, not that he was true to keeping that vow, and whether that vow was, you know, sinful in the sight of God or not. Going into, I'll use that to launch into Samson today, even that concept of the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Okay, we're going to see the Spirit of the Lord begins to move Samson from a very young age. But what about Samson's morality, right? God can use sinful people, and Samson is a great example of both. Here is this man who has great faith. He ends his life with a prayer to God. He knows God's in complete control. He ends his life with a prayer to God saying, give me one more, right? Return my strength to me one more time so that I can take vengeance on the Philistines. But he realizes his faith is ultimately in God from the very beginning as to where his power and his strength comes from. But yet his inner character leaves a lot to be desired as far as what drives him and what God uses of his personal character to fulfill his plan. And we will get into that today. So with that, let's go in, and I kind of find it very interesting here as we get into this next study. We go through three more of these, like we had with Tola and Jer before Jephthah, to where you really don't have a lot of information. We have Ibzan. He was from Bethlehem, and he judged Israel. He had 30 sons, and he gave away 30 daughters in marriage, so 60 children in all, and he brought in 30 daughters from elsewhere for his sons. So again, you have this, here he is, he's judging Israel, but yet that comment that he brought in 30 daughters from elsewhere for his sons leaves one to question. But he dies and he's buried at Bethel. The only real question with Jephthah is which Bethel? There is a Bethel that's down between Hebron and Jerusalem in the south here, that's here. And there is also a Bethel that's on the border between Zebulun and Asher. A lot of times this one is, you know, Bethlehem Ephrathah or Bethlehem of Judah. And then this one up here also has a name in which is given. We don't know which one of those two, which Bethlehem he's from. But one of those two Bethlehems. But this also kind of gives us this period of years to where it seems things are peaceful, right? This might actually be some nice pictures of how God said, this is how I expected it to be for my people. You've got a judge. The judge is just one to where if there's a matter that needs to be brought and say, what's the right thing to do here? The matter is brought. The judge gives the response, here's the right thing to do, and that matter is dealt with. But as far as there's no king in Israel, and there, you know, it seems to be this period of rest, so to speak, that we've seen in the cycle several times. And then we have Elon, Ibzan, Elon. And with Elon, we know that he's from Zebulun. So we know we're up here in this area up here where Zebulun's inheritance is. And he judged Israel. He judged Israel for another 10 years. And he died and he was buried at Alajahan up in this area as well, up in this area of Benjamin. I mean, up in this area of Zebulun. So with this, we either have one going on in the south and one up north, or two up here north in the same area. And then we come to verse 13, where we come to Abdon. Again, there's not a lot given about him, his son. The city is kind of thought to be over here in Manasseh. So in this central area of the world, or of their world, is where he would have lived. And he had 30 sons, 40 sons, 30 grandsons, who rode on 70 young donkeys, right? So, one, can we say that he was well-blessed, right? I think this is probably the best thing to do. It's just a statement of how blessed he was and how well cared for he was, in the sense that he had all of these sons. He had been blessed with all of these sons and the grandchildren, and they all rode on these young donkeys, a sign of prosperity, a sign of prestige that was going on there. And then he dies, and he is also buried up in this land. And with this, it brings us to this great character, Samson. And we pick up the cycle here again with one minor change. Again, chapter 13 and verse 1, again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord. So we see this sin comes back into the camp of Israel. And the Lord removes his protective hands and delivers them into the Philistines. And the Philistines oppressed them for 40 years. So again, we've had the oppression from the Ammonites where with Gideon. And with the days of Gideon, you had oppression from the Ammonites and the Philistines, but really the story of Jephthah, my apologies, the story of Jephthah kind of focuses on the Ammonites, even though the Philistines are noted there. One of the things I find kind of interesting in this particular one is I didn't read, and I could have just missed it, but I did not read where there's this crying out of repentance, this crying out of help. That seems to be missing from this particular cycle. But the cycle of sin is there, the oppression is there, and then it just kind of moves into this concept where we're going to pick up with Samson is one that when the man of God comes and the angel of the Lord comes and begins to speak with the woman, he says that, you know, this is the one he has planned to begin to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And then we'll see in chapter 7, 1 Samuel chapter 7, that there is peace from the Philistines in an ultimate level. A couple of things that I want us to think about from the story of Samson before we start looking. I mean, Samson is a story that we know well. We've known it. We've been told it since we were children. There are some details that's there for us as adults that's not, you know, that our Bible class teachers as children probably did not point out, but it's a story we know well with Samson, his great strength, his great might. But one of the things that I kind of like for us to notice as we go through, God makes it very clear who's in control. God is orchestrating this whole thing, right? You've got Samson, he's got some questionable morals, and yet God is going to use that to bring about his plan to deliver Israel. You got Samson's parents, and as we look through and as we watch Samson's parents seem to be extremely faithful people, right? Just watch their character as we come through this. And then we have Samson. We've talked a little bit about that. We'll spend some more on that. Israel, we have already seen the idolatry that's going on in the land, this, you know, and if they did evil again inside the Lord, it probably goes back to the idolatry that was going on. And we pick up this focus. We're going to focus for a period of time now on the Philistines. And do the Philistines go away with Samson? How long are the Philistines a thorn in Israel's side? Yeah, for years, right? 40 of them. Somebody else said something too. Yes. So we've got a long time before the Philistines stop being a thorn, right? We will continue with them, and we'll see the rest after Eli going into the last part of the Judges, but the Philistines will continue to be a thorn. I think it's very interesting that it points out that it begins to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And I've had this note a couple of times, and I thought this, then again, since today would be a good spot to drop this in. There is a note that's made by Solomon when he's building the temple that gives us a date frame, and I cannot remember if it's 530 or 580 years. Again, didn't have time to go find it this morning and bring it back and refresh it in my memory. But if you was to sit and add up all of the judges, right? You got, you know, Tola, Jer, each of these judged for some period of time. And we was to take the time that each of these judges judged. And then Saul, David, Solomon, how long were their reigns? Yeah, pretty well known, 40 years, you know, you got 40 years each there. And you add all of those together, and here you are in the beginning, in the days of Solomon and his reign, and you go, wait, the math does not add up. One of the things to keep in mind is most students believe that there is a lot of overlap going on. And I think there probably is some overlap going on here in the ones we're talking about today. So we think linear. When we start reading these scriptures and the Bible picks a way in which it's going to tell the stories, and each story has got a time, this went for 10 years or this went for 6 years. But that does not mean while that 6 years is going on in the land of Zebulun and someone is judging that the Philistines are not causing trouble in the central or the southern part. And you also have at the beginning of Jephthah, we talked about them being pinched. You got the Philistines coming in from this side, and you got Ammon coming in from that side. So you do have some possible overlaps going on through here. So if someone wants to say that, you know, go to the days of Solomon and say, hey, look, if you go add all that time up, it comes out to a lot more than what is stated here by Solomon in the days since they came out of Egypt, then this is why that you can't literally just do that math and add all of these together. And yes, if you was to do that, you would have more time than what Solomon is speaking of. But enough on that. He's a different kind of judge, right? It says the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. We talked about that sometimes being physical, sometimes that being prophet as far as the delivery of a message. I think we can very safely say with Solomon that the Spirit came upon him physically and made him physically strong, and he was blessed because of his Nazarite vow with great strength. He became a deliverer of Israel from a warrior point of view, but from a spiritual point of view, I think we could catalog some of his shortcomings as we go through there. So we will see that whether the story today or with Micah again next Lord's Day after singing on with Deborah. So, we're going to see his parents' great faith. We're going to see Samson himself knew where his strength comes from. So this is a positive, again, building up to what Brent was saying about when we see him listed as a man of faith in Hebrews. Samson well knows where his strength comes from. You see where he relies on the Lord, right? He knows where his strength comes from, his reliance is on God. He maintains that Nazarite vow. Talk about that more in just a minute, but he maintains that through his life in order to keep those blessings that he was given and promised. And he prays to God for help. And he was highlighted for his faith in Hebrews. So we see these very positive things about Samson, but at the same time, we see that his character has some serious flaws from an immorality point of view. The way he allowed, we'll just say the ladies in his life, the ones he sought out, caused him great trouble. So that seemed to be his downfall. And even with his parents and the Philistines, you see this flippancy in his attitude, right? It's almost as if he is toying with them. And in some ways he is, right? Whether it's the lady who is begging for the answer to the question, or whether it is his parents who's trying to say, why do you want to marry a woman of the Philistines? Isn't there someone around here that you would rather marry? Or even the Philistines, when I pose this riddle to you, and then when it all is said and done, he goes and kills 30 of their own people to take their tunics to give to him. You see this flippant attitude to where this arrogance almost in the way that he interacts with people. So he has good and he has bad, but God uses him as he is. Right? God uses him to fulfill his plan. And I just find it very interesting that Samson is much of a tale of two sides as we look at this. So as we begin to look into the story, just again, I like to start with the big picture. Here's the land of Israel. We're about to zoom in right here in this Philistine territory. And we're going to see up in this area, and Zorah is where he is born. And we're going to start talking about Timnah, which is where our first story is today. So this is in this area. So here's your coastline, here's Ashkelon, here's the area of the Philistines, Gath, Ashdod, and then you see from Zorah over toward the border there at Timnah is where we're talking about today. So we meet this great man, Manoah, and his wife. His wife was barren, she had no children. In verse 3, it just says, and the angel of the Lord appears to her, to the woman, and said to her, indeed now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Again, out of nowhere it appears, the statement is stated to her. Just start thinking about the emotions that's beginning to build in her as she's trying to weigh out what's being told to her, right? Probably has dealt with the fact that she's barren. She knows this. Wanted a child, can't have a child. You're going to have a child. Verse 4, now therefore, please be careful, right? Caution, be careful. Not to drink any wine or similar drink, not to eat anything unclean, for behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin, there in verse 5, he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistine. We can read that in a sentence, but can you imagine what it'd be like to be given that message? We can even see she's kind of overwhelmed by this message when she goes to repeat what's happened to her husband. Right, verse 6, she goes to repeat this to her husband and says, "A man of God came to me and his countenance was like the countenance of an angel of God. Very awesome." So the first thing she was kind of taken back from was who it was she was encountering, right? Man of God is usually what children of Israel referred to. If it was a man of God, it was what? A prophet. Usually a man of God was a prophet. But he had the countenance of the angel of God. Very awesome. So am I talking to a man or am I talking to an angel, a spiritual being? And we'll see that kind of debate between her and her husband both as we go through and finalized at the end. She said, "I didn't ask him where he was from and he didn't tell me his name." Probably because she was overwhelmed. This was happening and didn't understand what was going on. But he said to me, "I'm going to conceive and bear a son, not to drink any wine or similar drink or to eat anything unclean, for he will be a Nazarite to God from birth." Find it interesting that he appears to the wife and not the husband. The instructions are to the wife, not the husband. "You shall not drink anything, any wine, any fruit of the vine," which is what's repeated later. "You should not drink any wine or strong drink. Eat nothing unclean." She's about to bear this child. And while this child is in the womb, none of these things is to be consumed. He will be a Nazarite from the womb to the day of his death. So in other words, this is a Nazarite vow for the rest of his life. We'll see some for a short period of time later in Bible history. But this is one from the beginning of time to the end of time. So Manoah, what's his answer to this? This is a great family. What's his answer to it in verse 8? He prays, right? "I don't know what's happened. I'm confused about what's going on. Well, let's pray." He prayed to the Lord and said, "Oh my Lord, let this man of God whom you have sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born." And the Lord listened to him. The angel of the Lord comes back and he came to the woman again, right? Not to Manoah who prayed, but comes back to the woman again. And she was sitting in the field and Manoah, her husband, was not with her. So the woman ran in haste and got her husband, said, "Come back." So Manoah and his wife comes. Excuse me. And he said, "Are you the man that spoke to this woman earlier?" And he said, "I am." So Manoah says, let your words come to pass, right? Let what you say come to pass. Let your words come to pass. What shall this boy be this boy's rule of life and his work, right? They've already been told a little bit about his rule of life. He's going to be a Nazarite vow. But what's his work going to be? They've been told he's going to begin to deliver Israel. So his question is, what's his work? What's he going to be doing? What's he said to do? So the angel Lord said to Manasseh, "Of all that I've told to the woman, be careful." That's all you need to know. Of all that I've told to the woman, be careful. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine, not drink the wine or similar drink, or eat anything unclean as I've commanded her to observe. He's got so many questions. And the angel of the Lord said, "That's all you need to know. Go do that. You be sure that your wife does those things." So he does not continue to question. He just says, "Let us detain you, that we may prepare a young goat for you." And now we begin to see this interesting interchange between, if you're wondering, as they're wondering, who is this that I'm dealing with? Is this a prophet that's coming to give me a message? Or is this some kind of spiritual being? Is this an angel of the Lord or the Lord himself? "Stay and let me prepare a young goat for you." And he said, the angel of the Lord responds, "Though you detain me, I will not eat your food." I'm not going to sit down, whatever this is going to entail, I'm not going to sit down and eat your food. But if you want to offer a burnt offering, offer it to who? The Lord, right? So I'm not going to have your food, but if you want to offer a burnt offering, offer that burnt offering to the Lord. For Manoah did not know that he was the angel of the Lord. And then we keep coming. Manoah goes and he says, what is your name? That when your words come to pass, we may honor you. Right? Some translations aren't as firm about that, if your words come to pass. But this is very said fairly emphatically. When your words come to pass, we can say, who told us this? Right? What is your name? That when your words come to pass, we may honor you. And he says, why do you ask my name? Seeing that it is wonderful. So again, we're not given a clear answer. And you know what? The angel of the Lord doesn't give them a clear answer. But what does he tell them? Everything they need to know. Right? Is there anything that they're not told that they need to know? Here's what the woman should do. She should abstain from anything unclean, abstain from anything of the vine. You go and do this. So Manoah takes the young goat, he puts the grain off, puts it with a grain offering and offers it up on the rock to the Lord. And as they watch the flames of this offering, this burnt offering, go up to the Lord, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flames. And when this happens, Manoah and his wife saw this, they just fall to the ground, right? And really, when you come into the presence of something this awesome, what else can you do when you experience something this, and I use awesome in its truest sense, all filled. When you see something this awesome, what else can you do than what happened in verse 20 when you just fall to the ground? And then he said, when the angel of the Lord appeared to them no more, Manoah knew that this was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to his wife, we shall surely die because we have seen God. Interesting response, but also a very clear indication that this is a man and a woman who knows who God is. What did God say to Moses? Can you look on my face and live? So there's some true Bible knowledge that they're putting together. We have seen God, we're going to die. But Manoah's wife continues to reason with him and said, if he had desired to kill us, one, wouldn't have accepted our burnt offering. Two, wouldn't have accepted this burnt offering and grain offerings. And he wouldn't have told us all of these magical or majestic things that are about to happen. Right? So if he was going to kill us, these things, we wouldn't have even been told about what was going to happen, because obviously if I'm dead, I can't bear a child. This child can't begin to deliver Israel. So even in the overwhelming emotion of what's going on, she's kind of the voice of reason going on in the back of his mind. Where have we seen, this concept of the angel of the Lord? Where have we encountered this before? Going back to Abraham, Genesis chapter 16, Genesis chapter 22, you have the angel of the Lord coming down and speaking. Where else? Yes. Specifically, help me out. Yes. I was trying to remember the chapter, but yeah, the angel of the Lord appears to him as the great warrior. He comes up. Are you for us or against us? And that encounter happens. It's right at the very beginning of the story of the invasion of the land. And in Exodus chapter 3, this is the same phrase that's used to the burning bush. The angel of the Lord was in the burning bush, spoke to Moses. Now, what about this wonderful? I can't tell you because my name is wonderful, or it's too wonderful. Does that just bring a passage to mind? Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, where it is spoken that that is speaking of Christ, in which it said this. Again, we see these links through here. Really, what is this angel? I like how Kiel and Dillich says it. The angel to whom the invisible God reveals himself to men. Right? So this angel of the Lord, regardless whether it was some form of the deity itself or as we see in Revelations, Michael the archangel or whoever it may be, this is the angel in whom the invisible God reveals himself to man. So regardless, this is God and his word coming forth to mankind to reveal himself to mankind and to take that message forth. And really, that's what the word angel means, is a messenger. So this is the messenger of the Lord. So the woman, she bears a son, and he begins to grow. Verse 25, very important. The Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him and made Nahim, Dan, between Zorah and Eshkelon. So Mahanaim, I don't know if I've got it on this map or not, but we do have Zorah here and Eshkelon here. So somewhere in that area, the Spirit of the Lord, oh, it's the little call-out box there. The Spirit of the Lord begins to move upon him, and he begins to notice these things that's going on. I find interesting in chapter 14 when it opens, now Samson went down to Timnah, and a few minutes later, it's like he goes back and speaks to his parents and says, go get her. So, you know, I think of it when I was young and I was a kid, me and my friends, we go rambling through the field. Well, Samson went rambling, but he went rambling from, you know, he went rambling from here down to Timnah. So obviously this is, he's older, and this is him and his friends going out to the areas around. So this isn't just he was out next to his house and he sees this woman in Timnah. He and his friends have gone and taken a trip. So, well, I'm sorry, Samson, he went down to Timnah. And he saw a woman in Timnah, the daughter of the Philistines. And he goes back and he tells his father, make sure I get this quote right. He went back, he tells his father, I've seen this woman in Timnah, the daughter of the Philistines. Now go and get her for me. Right? Usually it's the father telling the son, here's your instructions for the day. What we have now is a role reversal. And Samson comes back and begins to tell his father, hey, I saw this girl, this lady down in Timnah. I want her to be my wife. Go get her for me, right? Go do it. Here, Dad, go do it. Do you think Samuel was treated special from the day he was born? What are some of the things that you know he was told from the day he was born? Where's your power? In the fact you're not eating of the fruit of the vine and your hair cannot be cut, right? So you have this great power. You're special. He's being told since the day he was born how special he was. And so by this age, he's been told enough that he now believes it. I am special. That's what I want. Father, go get her for me. I will now tell you what to do. Father is distraught. Why do you want me to go to the Philistines and get someone from the uncircumcised? Again, parents seem to be faithful followers of God, and this would destroy a faithful parent for their son to say, go get this unbeliever and bring her to me so that she can be my wife. Right? That would destroy, if you want to put yourself in their position, that would destroy a faithful parent to be told, go get her for me. What they don't know is that God is working through this character of Samson to bring it about. She pleases me well. They beg. He says, go get her for me. So Samson goes down to Timnah with his father and his mother. Now, to his surprise, the story we know so well, so we'll go through it at a quicker pace. The story we know so well is, to his surprise, a young lion comes out and begins to attack, and he rips it to pieces. It says, as one would rip a goat apart. And I don't think that we know that. You know, that phrase doesn't even help us much. Philip, what's the last time you went out and just ripped a goat apart? Was that hard or easy, right? I don't know that we've gone out and ripped a goat apart to know how hard or easy it was, but he had nothing in his hands. So he had no tool with which to do it, but he just rips a line apart as if one would rip a smaller animal in half and leaves it to the side. And as they're coming back through, he notices that a swarm of bees, they've gone and they're coming back for the wedding feast. And he says that he notices a swarm of bees has set up shop in this carcass. And for a Jew, should he touch a dead body? A dead carcass? No. But he sees it and he goes and he takes of the honey, feeds it to, goes, catches up with his parents, feeds it to them. And then as they're beginning the wedding feast, and she brings him, he's in the foreign land, so she brings him 30 companions to be his groom's party, and says, while they're partying, while they're having their festivities, he says, I got a riddle for you. Would you care to hear it? Tell me the riddle. Out of the eater comes something sweet. Out of the eater comes something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. And if you can tell that, 30 changes of clothes. If you can't solve it, you'll give me 30 changes of clothes. If you can solve it, I'll give you 30 changes of clothes. So the last lesson we'll talk about here today is, as this is unfolding, after they can't solve it, they go to his potential wife and they say, you brought us here to take our stuff. You brought us here to gather and to celebrate, but you brought us here to take our stuff. You find out what this riddle is, or we'll come and burn your house. Kind of like what Ephraimite said to Jephthah. We'll come and we're going to burn your house, your father and everybody with it. We'll burn your house down. But it says for 7 days, she's wanted to know the answer to this riddle as well, and he will not tell it. I've not told my father. I've not told my mother. Why would I tell it to you? But what happens? She wears him down. She continues to push. And we know, right? I mean, we've seen it how many times through history that longing for affection from him, that wanting to please, all of that with time, she continues to beg and continues to beg. He continues to say no. She continues to push. And he gives in and tells her the riddle. Isn't that true of, that's going to be true of him in the future too, is it not? You know, this is a character flaw of his. Tells her the answer to the riddle. They answer the riddle. And when they answer the riddle, he said, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not know the answer to my riddle. But again, when we start talking about him being flippant, how does he go about getting them and paying his vow back, or his bet back, so to speak? Yeah. He goes down and kills 30 of their own and takes their possessions and gives it to these 30 companions. He goes away. He's mad. He goes back home. The Lord continues to move to begin to deliver Israel. And in all of that, that last verse, and I'll leave it there for Micah to pick up, but that last verse, and the best they gave the lady to his best man. You know, that sounds crazy in our ears. But that's what happened. He's left. The father thought he was gone. So the lady was given to his companion, to his best man, to be his wife. And that will key up the next story that Micah will go into next time. Thank you for your comments this morning. Hope Micah's better.